Viewed from the lens of a business, whether in the form of t-shirts, movies, amusement parks, or even cruises, the ubiquity of Disney's empire is a sight to behold. Viewed as a cultural phenomenon, the company and the legacy of its founder in particular demonstrate similarly profound impacts on the moral framework of America and increasingly the world. Tonight we discuss with culture warrior and friend Borzoi how Disney transformed from a traditional storyteller with works such as Cinderella to a revolutionary one with feminist tales and Frozen, as well as the future of the company and how the culture wars going forward can be fought more effectively.
Well, I'm not a crook. I've burned everything I've got.
Military-industrial complex.
A new world order.
But we are here to destroy the control over the industry of other people.
I did not trade arms for hostages.
It's been time.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is actually part two of an episode that we had tried to do in the past, and unfortunately, we were unable to publish the episode. We got out of the way. We're going to do this a second time, and the first time as well, we had Borzoi on co-hosting with us, and we are pleased to welcome him back once again. Hello, Borzoi. How are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great, guys. I'm very excited to talk about this. I loved the episode that was never released, so I'm happy to do it again.
Well, I suppose there's some advantages to this also because our previous guest had a very, I would say, obtuse take on the question because he was unwilling to, you know, really just apply Occam's razor. Namely, we are talking about Walt Disney, Disney Corporation, and how something that went from producing, you know, wholesome European folk stories to basically being a device of Jewish culture distortion and perversion. So where do you want to start, boys?
Well, anybody watch Disney Plus lately?
It's Disney's actually had a $5 billion revenue decline. And Disney Plus, from what I saw, is actually declining in terms of its viewership, and it's practically losing money. They are hosting it at cost right now. Some of the discussions I've seen kind of just from the business community, one of them is, why has Disney kind of lagged on putting its 20th Century Fox properties onto Disney Plus? And two, apparently they are now charging additional fees to see new films on top of the existing subscription fee, and they won't give you a rebate. So you actually have to pay extra money to use the service to view content. So it's a company that's rapidly in decline. For those who aren't aware, Bob Iger, who's been the longtime CEO of Disney and has overseen much of the growth the last two decades practically, actually had to forego his retirement to try and manage Disney through the crisis. So it is apt that we're talking about it. Disney is now even deeper in its decline since I think we last spoke on the topic.
Actually a good thing, though, when you think about it, because you think about all the children who will be safer now that Bob Iger has less free time.
This is a good point. The man is not wrong. It does make me wonder, part of the strategy as well is that they've been aware that there's going to be problems coming down the road. So the purpose was to buy up every IP as much as possible, because that's your insurance for when there's I think there's gonna be a content crunch. We are reaching peak content. There's going to be a crunch at some point, and a lot of the technology for this stuff doesn't seem to be the most stable environment at this time. But if you have the IPs, then when you get through this, you'll have those same properties, and not, you know, they never let go of this stuff. They're In fact, copyright law is designed around how far ahead the Disney Corporation thinks, where it used to be, it was 13 years after the author's death. That was what the copyright basically was. I know it's gone through a number of evolutions, but Disney Corporation has made it so that it's in perpetuity.
Yeah, they were able to lobby for that. I thought it was only 100 years, but from extension from like 75, but I didn't know it was perpetuity. So they all own the mouse.
I think it's one of those legal trickeries where it's technically the 75 years, but there's loopholes that allow you to basically renew it for one reason or another, if I'm not mistaken. I'm not a lawyer on this, obviously, but as I understand, it's effectively in perpetuity. Because it gives them enough time to redo the laws in some way so that they can get the copyright again.
Well, there is an interesting aspect, too, in that Sumner Redstone recently died, the former mogul of
Viacom.
And he had this phrase, you know, content is king. And the Sumner Redstone model was effectively a pure acquisition and grow model. And Disney has, I think, really undertaken that model for many decades now, ever since really the 1980s has been on a acquisition spree. And it's not really going well from what I think people can kind of piece together. A lot of analysts are actually quite disappointed in Disney. The Disney 20th Century Fox deal, which was very questionable. I know that there was some question of potential antitrust investigation into that sort of deal. Actually was performed with debt, with liquid debt. Disney has actually gone into debt now to do content acquisition, which is not Sumner Redstone's model. So they've actually undertaken a mission, much to their own detriment. And, it's quite clear now that it's no longer about strictly producing entertainment. It's really a large holding company for a variety of different kinds of previously created entertainment, and then finding different ways to essentially repackage that entertainment, package merchandising around it, package, live entertainment, live theme parks, live attractions around it. Disney has really gotten out of the pure content creation business. A lot of their original IPs have actually done quite poorly. Even some of the Pixar stuff has started to do quite poorly. So they are now totally reliant on using debt to finance the acquisition and repackaging of content that's been produced by others, which is, a very, very peculiar model. I don't really think that's what Walt Disney intended, and I don't really think that's a sustainable strategy.
This reminds me of the Electronic Arts of the video game world acquiring these properties from independent development houses and then just churning out sequel after sequel with little to no true creative innovation at all. So I think the most easy example in that company is probably the sports or football or Madden series, where I think we're on probably like the 30th iteration at this point. And it's basically the same game mechanics, and they just update the jersey names. And I don't even know if they do anything more than that. I mean, it is that basic.
And EA has gotten in trouble, just from it, you're right. It's very similar to Disney for the video game world. They're kind of the bane of that sphere now. They basically just make sequels and DLC titles for existing property, and they're often criticized for what Disney is now doing on Disney Plus from a financial standpoint, right, where you basically buy something that's incomplete with one of the other streaming services, that baseline streaming service that you get, what's in it is there. Like with Netflix, you're not required to pay really any extra money for something once it's on Netflix. But EA does this where you buy an basically incomplete game and they charge you over the next year or two for more content for that game. And Disney is now, just descended into the depths of pure shareholder enrichment to the point where it's like a payment plan just to get or like an installment plan just to get the content that you want, I guess. Again, we'll get into this. This is really not at all what Walt Disney saw as the overall mission statement for his company. Nothing quite like this was undertaken during his time.
I find this topic of Disney is something I've been thinking about it for the last couple of days, and I find myself so difficult to wrap your mind around it, because we're obviously analyzing right now from the business perspective, but it seems they've shifted heavily towards this idea of Disney as identity, because you want to keep on, you ultimately your customer base comes and goes, but it's the hardcore people that matter the most in terms of this, and the more that you can have them identify with your brand, the more of that stable base you have. And there are some kind of groundwork. There's some groundwork that's built for this with the kind of multimedia, multi-reality experience that they started, that Disney started creating with the theme parks and all that. I was thinking, it's like, what a weird thing that they created with the theme park. I'm going to create this media property, and now I'm going to give you a chance to interact with that media property in real life and pay for the experience of that. It's a bizarre thing, and I now understand why a lot of the continental philosophical types like Umberto Eco and Jean Baudrillard were so baffled and perplexed by it.
Well, there's a great channel on YouTube, Defunct Land, and another one, Bright Sun Films, but Defunct Land is kind of more relevant to this. But they've both done, and you know, kind of videos on the history of different attractions that Disney's made. And Disney used to do theme parks or water parks or just kind of outdoor spaces that were not necessarily tied to one specific piece of content. It was maybe more like themed for the area, right? Mm-hmm. And like at Disneyland at one point in the 60s and 70s, one of the big attractions at Disneyland was like a donkey ride. Like it wasn't themed. It wasn't part of some franchise. You literally like went on a donkey and took a nice little trip through the Southern California, Anaheim, kind of grassy hills for an hour. And then you had a picnic.
Well, one of them, the most famous of all of the Disney rides was Pirates of the Caribbean. And right. That existed, you know, well before the film franchise. Of course, after the film franchise came out, they had to retcon the ride to incorporate the intellectual property of the film.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, like you go look at what the original parks as well. Even when they started to move towards themes within them, it was the names bear out what they were: Adventureland, Frontierland, Fantasyland, right. Tomorrowland. It's exactly what it says on the tin. Like, okay, we want to give you some variety here, but it's just we're going to have this based in some kind of very broad notion and setting. So I imagine like the donkey ride probably was originally part of Frontierland, or Frontierland incorporated the theme because they had the donkey there, whichever came first. But there's this sense of like, okay, I'm going to go to this picturesque encapsulation of a story, or like a feeling of a setting, an old west, but I'm not interacting with media characters. I'm here to put on some like a cowboy outfit and get my picture taken because that's kind of cute and kitschy.
And they had things like, I think they got rid of it. Remember like Tom Sawyer Island was a thing, you know, they would incorporate like a lot of Mark Twain. There would be more.
Is that the one where they had like jigaboos eating watermelons by the river?
I can't remember, but I think like for a while, you know, the idea was not just like creating original content, but also paying homage to older content and to like themes that inspired Walt Disney and themes that kind of inspired kind of general American youth culture in the early 20th century. So King Arthur, the stories of Mark Twain are both kind of featured prominently, or they used to be featured more prominently. And that was what kind of drove the imagination of kids then, was, oh, you know, like go pull the sword from the stone and have like a little fun kind of Renaissance-esque thing, or you have the Old West, or you have the Tom Sawyer stuff. You know, it wasn't always like, you know, this movie, The Ride, right?
Yeah.
Or it wasn't always this comic book, The Ride, or this comic book, The Movie. You know, it didn't really exist in that way. I think like that's really a product of Disney in the 1990s when Iger and all those guys kind of come on the scene. It turns into the multimedia franchise.
I think Eisner was probably the guy who really did the full-on cross-selling stuff, where you have the toys, you have the t-shirts, you have everything that's possibly imaginable, purchasable by the consumer, and sold. And go ahead, Nick.
You have two different, I mean, there's a behind Disney, I mean, you have something that is very valuable. You know, you have the imagination of children, and that translates into two things. It translates into money, and it translates as well into, you know, psychological and spiritual domination and manipulation of the people. And I didn't really want to talk about this before we talked about, you know, the good and, you know, pay some respect to Walt Disney, the man. However, since we are talking about the theme park, I think we might as well just address it now and then work backwards. So there is a dark satire that came out a few years ago that was shot largely guerrilla style, called Escape from Tomorrow, right? Which is a reference in of itself to Tomorrowland, which also was made into a film by, I think, in my opinion, one of the least Jewish, spiritually Jewish filmmakers who makes children's films, Brad Bird. It wasn't actually a bad movie, Tomorrowland, that is. It had, I think, George Clooney in it.
Yeah.
I mean, its worst crime is that it was boring. It wasn't like...
Yeah, it wasn't... Yeah, weird. It wasn't perverted. It was... Yeah. What was so strange about that film in particular, I think, was that it was the kind of film that really didn't fit in the era in we live. It was a bizarrely optimistic film, something that could have been made many, many years ago. And that, I think, was the point of the movie. But that's what made it kind of surreal watching it. It's like nobody watching this film believes that this has any resemblance to what the future holds for us. And I like Brad Bird. I mean, Brad Bird's the one who did The Incredibles, which is a good film. The sequel, not so much, which I actually saw in theaters when it came out because I liked the original. I was the only person, you know, who didn't have a kid watching it with my buddy.
The only person with a copy of the Turner Diaries underneath his coat while watching it too.
Yeah, you're correct. Well, the original one, I mean, I know that the writer Paul Kersey was a big fan of that as well, because the film does, I mean, the original Incredibles film does have very inegalitarian themes. I mean, that's the whole message of it. And the problem with the sequel is it kind of walks that back a little bit. But Brad Bird's cool. He made Iron Giant also. There's also Iron Giant nods in the Tomorrowland film, which I liked. But Escape from Tomorrow, on the other hand, was an independent film that, again, was shot more or less guerrilla style. So without permission of Disney to do it. And I don't know how they got away with some of this stuff, because they did use the names of certain rides and things like that. But they did. And I think I'm the only one who watched this besides Borzoi. What were your impressions of Borzoi?
So I want to preface this with a little bit, because this was a very interesting and bizarre experience watching this for me. And there's a number of reasons why that is. And because I watched it with my fiance, and she was kind of curious about this when I had told her that, hey, I'm doing this podcast. They want me to watch this movie called Escape from Tomorrow. And she asked, what's that about? I tell her what you just said. So we decided to sit down and watch it. And she doesn't mind like crudely made movies or unselling movies. But we had to pause the movie several times and ended up talking some stuff out, because she found it a very, very surreal experience for two reasons. One, the male anxiety within the movie, especially the anxiety of fatherhood. She actually asked me, is this the kind of stuff that men actually, fathers are actually afraid of, like that their sons might not be their own? Or is this the kind of anxieties that men actually have? And the other thing was, I found out she's never actually been to a theme park, and a lot of the scenes that the non-horror-esque scenes actually terrified her even more. I found out she's actually got this revulsion to theme parks. She calls it simulated and fake fun, and she's never really she's only seen theme parks on television and movies, and she's never liked it. And when I told her this reaction that the director of this movie, because I looked into this, the director of the movie, his wife was a nurse from the former Soviet Union. She had never, the first time she went to a theme park, she said this was worse than working the psych ward at the hospital. The movie is very effective in the theme park dread. Now it kind of goes off the rails, and ultimately I don't think the director had a strong vision of what he wanted to do with the movie. I think he just had a certain couple ideas and he wanted to see if he could execute it guerrilla style. But where it's extremely effective is in how unsettling it is in terms of the way that it marries the how one bad day at a simulated fake place that's supposed to be fun can go so dark and awry in so many unusual ways.
I don't think it was a lack of vision. I think that it was its flaws are more due to the limitations that came from the production.
Mm-hmm.
There were just certain things that he could not do right because of what he was working with. A, low budget, and B, not having actual legitimate access to the sets that he wants to use. I think it's actually a pretty coherent film, and I think it hits on a lot of things that have been floating around in the conspiracy world for a long time, so to speak. Disney always has kind of served as is an interesting and dark metaphor for America in the sense that it was, you know, it presents a very innocent facade, but beneath that, I mean, you have some very sinister things happening, things that we can verify have happened, considering things that have come out, revelations have come out regarding child abuse in the past few years. I mean, this is stuff that most of us knew was happening, but more people have been forced to, you know, address. Ongoing theme in it is trauma-based mind control. And one of the things that I've seen talked about with respect to Disney films in general is there is a strong, I mean, most Disney films, I mean, this is not true only of Disney films. This is true of a lot of mythology and folklore in general, but it often begins or involves heavy elements of trauma. Recurring themes are, you know, the sudden and unexpected death of the father, abandonment, things like this that can actually, you know, they traumatize children, and this helps imprint these things onto their minds for better or for worse, you know. And what you see in that, I mean, there's implications, for example, that the protagonist is himself a victim of some kind of trauma and that he's having these hallucinations and, you know, almost schizophrenic episodes because he's being triggered, but based on past trauma. And the thing about something like Disney is it's so widespread, you know, everyone has seen this and it's a template. I mean, that's what they're doing. Like, I kind of look at, for example, the Marvel, the cape shit as them trying to do the same thing that they did to children, to adults. And it kind of works because of the Yeah, they seeded it already. And so they're putting the same patterns in. And this is the stuff that people, I mean, they are the dream makers, right? And this is the nightmare that they've projected onto the American mind. And it's something that I don't think really very many people are fully removed from. Some people maybe go to, like, you know, really kind of specialized esoteric schools that, like, prohibit them from watching this kind of stuff. I know of a few of those. But for the most part, I mean, this is a mass phenomenon.
Did you interpret the ending then kind of as the abuser claiming the soul of the victim kind of way?
Yeah, I mean, well, he's basically, I mean, spoiler, like he's replaced and turned into, there's a big theme of emasculation, right? I mean, if the father is taken out of the picture, if the immediate authority is gone, then the family is totally at the mercy of, you know, these sort of occult powers is how I took it.
And that makes sense because you have that scene with this would-be Imagineer, basically. There's this implication that there's different factions or forces fighting, but that's never really made clear. And you have no idea to what extent this supposed battle that's going on, you know, beneath the surface is real or not. But you do have this Imagineer-type character who's a construction himself, who basically is looking for these implanted memories within his head, and that this is your memory of who you're supposed to be. So I can see what you're saying. I can see with that where you're going with that.
Well, and also you have other themes like the sexual exploitation of, you know, American children by foreigners.
Yeah, that's a big one right there with the. That was actually one of my biggest disappointments with the movie, is that they didn't explore that. That it gets one call out and then one confirmation, and it doesn't really go any further with that. I think that would have been, just from a filmmaking perspective, that would have been a lead to pursue a little bit further into the movie. But
well, my overall take would be that the idea is that it's a theme park. Well, it's a theme park for who?
Yeah,
you know, you have you know, it's a playground, you know, for basically perverts and exploiters and alien forces, essentially.
Sorry, go ahead.
You know, it presents itself as in an inviting way for people, you know, to fall into the trap. And then, you know, you have like the protagonist is being led around by these nymph figures.
Yeah.
Right. And so it uses sex and, you know, the charm of innocence for, you know, on the multi level, you have different things that the different figures are trying to get out of it, even on the family level. What the children want, what the father wants, what the wife wants, and then the forces that actually run the show, what they want out of it. And, you know, things are never what they seem.
They operate right in the open in real life as well. It's just people either choose not to see it or they don't understand what they're looking at. I mean, secret societies and secret clubs exist all across the Disney clubs. Club 33 is one of the more well-known private lounges. But there's even these what's called Disneyland social clubs, which is groups of Disneyland fans who basically function like motorcycle gangs, and they're very secretive. There's very little that's known about their subculture, and they've gotten into trouble for basically engaging in protection money rackets on other factions within this Disneyland, Disney World club world. It's a very bizarre but very real, very criminal reality that exists under the surface of this manufactured fun.
Well, it's a perfect metaphor for America. I mean, it really is.
Also, so over the last like 2-3 years, there's been a number of high profile mass arrests of child porn distributors and child predators, many of whom were part of a ring who were working together. And in that ring, several were employees of Disney, predominantly down in Florida. There have been a series of arrests made both the last year and this year on an ongoing investigation. And so these people, some of whom work in the park, some of whom have worked in Disney corporate for over 20 years. And they come from all walks of life: janitors, content experience managers, park employees. There is definitely a child porn problem amongst a network of Disney employees. And it's just slowly kind of been cracked open to the surface. And I think Borzoi is right. There's probably many factions within this sprawling company with interests that I think we would find, you know, horrid or distasteful. And it's sort of shocking that this is only now kind of coming to the surface, and who knows how long these networks have been operating within Disney, and how these people were recruiting each other and how they were making contact with each other. I mean, how does this work? Do you like walk up to other Disney employees and say, "Hey, I'm a fucking pedophile. Like, are you one too?" I mean, it's sort of, if you ever look at the number of children that go missing at Disney parks or Disney facilities, it's kind of shocking.
I didn't really want to go there, but basically, I mean, think about it. Like, you're talking about a firm with a lot of money that controls very large pieces of property that by their own design, like on their surface, they have a lot of, you know, underground labyrinth type structures. You know, people, they're there's a lot of things that can be hidden in a place like that. Right.
Yeah.
They have their own private security. You know, they have the ability to control this completely, and they have things that, you know, nobody else knows about. I mean, it's as simple as that.
And there's a lot of social clubs, and some of them are official, some of them are unofficial, and even the unofficial ones, because Disney is known for having this a special relationship with people who want to promote their stuff. If you want to take video of Disneyland or Disney World, if they don't think it's going to cause any negative image to them, they let people do that. It's not, they do not care about this stuff. And it's, but they do monitor and they do keep an eye on it. So you constantly have these cameras. You have so many employees. It's so easy for many of these people, because it is a surveillance park, for people to notice, like, oh, this guy comes here a lot. Oh, this guy's part of this club. I can kind of, like, maybe I'll go talk to him at this point. They have ways of signaling out to one another, especially when you have all this different stuff. Then you have all these factions, these social clubs, these secret societies that do exist. I mean, I mentioned Club 33. Who knows? That's the known private lounge. Who knows what other lounges that aren't even officially listed? We know they have to exist just because the amount of people that have made mention of them. It's just they're not officially on the books in any capacity. The thing is, like, the sexual harassment is prevalent on every single level as well. I'll send you the link, Adam, for the notes. But there was a story, I remember, from 12 years ago, and I had to find a web archive of it, of a guy who played Captain Jack Sparrow for one of the parks. And because that was a very popular character, he had no shortage of women that, drunk and sober and barely legal and not even legal, that were constantly propositioning him as the character. This is what I was getting at, this whole Disney as identity aspect in the Disney fantasy that they sell people on. And he's like looking at this from a detached kind of, like, oh, this is, look at how crazy it is to be a Disney character. Look what I've gotten myself into. He's just a regular guy. How many of these thousands of people that work there have realized what a great way this is to get access to people I want to have access to?
Yeah, I mean,
yeah, and they have that city too. What is that? I think it's in one of the American Gulf states. They have that little—I don't know if you can call it a city, but it's a—it is a Disney-owned town, and it's not a theme park per se. It's like people live there.
Well, I know they have those cruises, and cruises even before COVID were bad enough. But the fact that it's a Disney-run cruise with Goofy popping through the hallways would just drive me absolutely overboard, literally.
In international waters.
Yeah, with the sharks, I'd take the sharks over that.
Yeah, I mean, not even the Freemasons are.
I think it's in Florida.
Not even the Freemasons are organized to the extent that the Disney organization is, in terms of the layers of complexity and the layers of truth and what you're allowed to know within an organization has. Disney is the ultimate secret society.
Yeah, and I guess we should consider how it is that we got to this point, because these certainly weren't the intentions of Walt Disney, who by all accounts was an honorable man.
Jews couldn't stop bitching about him, so I guess there's got to be something there.
Well, yeah, and also he was one of the few people in Hollywood who, when Leni Riefenstahl visited the United States, he showed her an early copy of Fantasia in a private screening. And they were quite upset about that, too.
He had his brother. You know, his brother kind of helped run the show as he went into decline. So he wasn't alone, but he was definitely sort of a pariah, I think, in the early days. The company was, like, always in debt and always on the verge of bankruptcy in the 40s. I remember, like, one apocryphal story. He actually took out a loan from his own life insurance just to have enough working capital to keep his little animation operation alive. So he was, you know, he like fundamentally believed in what he was doing. He you know, this was his life's mission, and he, by all accounts, you know, drew a great deal of joy in the artistry and in, you know, the distribution of this, you know, very kind of milquetoast and quaint content by today's standards. There's nothing particularly flashy about it, but it drew people's imagination, and it was fun, and it was to the point and poignant. And then I think in the 50s, after him and his brother both passed, the company immediately just went into decline. no one could really figure out how to run Disney properly as like a, as like an equity shack until Eisner and all those crew came in the 80s and 90s. Like it from like I think the from 1960 to 1980, Disney was always teetering on the edge of failure, just because it wanted to stick to this original vision that Walt had had kind of created for it, and it was not intended to be a massive holding company for all kinds of multimedia products. It was intended strictly as sort of almost like an art house as a company, and you know they would indulge in little like quaint theme parks and property acquisition, but certainly not into mass marketing and certainly not into acquiring other people's property. I think that Walt probably would have frowned on that sort of behavior of taking others' property and then just trying to repackage it. It was more focused on using what they had and then trying to do something that was based on sort of common folk themes or common old stories and retell them in a more modern way. But he was certainly not interested in going to other film studios and purchasing their products. That's when the Wall Street guys take over Disney and it becomes strictly about equity distribution.
Well, like many things, it was something that the enemy never could have created. They could only take it over and degrade right. it and use it as a weapon against us.
He's kind of in some sense the Norman Rockwell of the film really, because he was drawing on a lot of well, I mean, because he did live action and animation, and even in the live action has some of these like these folk tale. Quaint and what his many numerous detractors often called overly optimistic and sentimental sensibilities that he has. That's I kind of get this when I think about all that all the old Disney properties when he that were around when he was still alive. I get that feeling and that sense from it. There's a quaintness to it, even for the time period.
It's almost like Jimmy Stewart movies would be too harsh for Walt. You know, they're too edgy.
Have you seen like the American art scene in the 1920s and 30s? It was absolutely terrible. Like it's just terrible art. It's all this terrible expressionism. Like you know, the United States imported all of this refuse from Europe to come do terrible art. And you know he was the bane of the artistic community strictly because he wasn't indulging in this kind of ridiculous fawning over art that is just fundamentally ugly and bleak and sort of ostentatious in its sort of blandness. He kind of was a guy that focused on the classical form, the, you know, right. the classical sense of drawing, the classical sense of framing, of having something you can actually visually interpret. You know, in the 1920s and 30s, even the early 40s, that was an aberration in the American art scene. If you go to any like major art gallery in the United States and you look at the art from that period, it is predominantly terrible. And he was probably hated by these people because he didn't go along with that. He was from Kansas, right? He was a normal guy. That didn't really want to, didn't understand this sort of foreign approach to American art.
Well, I've always shared the sensibility that Disney had in terms of just what my preferences are. Obviously, I wouldn't be able to create the brilliant masterpieces that I thought were really the Disney classics, the stuff that really people think of today as true Disney Arcana and Americana, things like Snow White, the Seven Dwarfs, and things that really come from Europe and have kind of a character to them that is tied to the forest and medieval times. If you look at what they were trying to do not only after Disney died, when I think his brother was trying to piece things together, but especially after they brought in the New Yorkers to try to appease Wall Street, at least, the style really changed. And it became much more multicultural, much more progressive, much more liberal. And also the animation tone and style changed dramatically. It became much more digitized, obviously, but even before it became fully digital with the acquisition of Pixar and just the really just overemphasis on digital, which I've never particularly cared for. I don't really like the sense that I'm looking at a computer screen. I want to actually enjoy a work of art. For some reason, I find it more fantastical. But even before that, you could look at something like Lion King and see that the way the pencil or whatever instrument they were putting on paper and then probably transcoding through a computer, the way they did that just lacked the sense of detail and care and the lack of probably painting as well, like the watercolors that I'm trying to recall. I didn't really watch these much after I was a child, but I do recall the sense of wonder when I watched those films. And I share Disney's confusion when it comes to things like modern art. I don't understand why this is particularly interesting or even good looking. I mean, obviously, it's usually quite offensive aesthetically. Maybe it's thought provoking in other ways, but for children especially, this is not something that you need to start imparting in your movies. And that's what a lot of the more recent films have done. They've put a lot of the feminist agenda into it. They put a lot of the multicultural agenda into it. And it's
a lot of the gay agenda is I think correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't a recent animated film from them have a bisexual?
It's a Disney Plus show. It features the first openly like bisexual POC character. I think like the character is supposed to be like Guatemalan or something.
Oh, great. I mean,
so they're not just going after American children anymore.
Well, yeah, that's the global model now, is to inflict the damage they've been busy inflicting on America to the whole planet. I mean, if you guys remember, I believe ABC was one of the larger mainstream supporters of the war in Iraq and things like that. And Disney owns ABC. So the Walt Disney Corporation was like doing the propaganda bit for war in Iraq back in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
Just to kind of give you an idea for this is not the Mickey Mouse Company. You know, this is a company with global ambition that is committed to crafting films that are more and more stupid and more just kind of like pure visual experience. Who was was it Martin Scorsese who was like verbally accosted for saying these films are just theme park rides?
Yeah, yeah. He was talking specifically about Cape Shit. And also what you're saying that reminds me of the ending of Full Metal Jacket, where, you know, they're walking away from the slaughter with the M-I-C-K-E-Y. M-O-U-S-E, who's the leader of the pack that's made for you and me, you know.
Well, and the funniest thing about all that, and this is where there may be some kernel of truth in this criticism that was made, but they definitely projected a lot of this and then embraced that projection. Because what Walt Disney, the man, was criticized for with him and his company is that he was that his stuff was overly commercial because of its sentimentality, and that the patriotism and individualism within it, and that, but also what you see and hear a lot of criticism of him is that he's very imperialistic. Well, if Walt Disney is imperialistic, then I don't know what you call post-Walt Disney Disney Corporation. If that man was imperialistic, what this all is. Everything that his critics of his time accused him of, the Walt Disney Corporation has actually embraced and taken as an actual virtue and value.
Well, as Nick said, these people could not have created this on their own. And so these critics are probably like the same NKVD descendants that eventually spawned Michael Eisner and Bob Iger, who took over the company and then went about opening Disneylands on multiple continents, basically trying to create content that can be approached and consumed by the entire planet equally. And undertaking a massive effort to slowly build up its presence in media distribution, streaming, sports, and just about every piece of popular American kind of pulp content in order to reach the broadest appeal possible. Again, Walt Disney being a quote imperialist is like just the ultimate projection given how Disney operates now. I don't know, because I don't watch a lot of these movies anymore, but does Disney actually put out anything original anymore? Has that happened in the last few years? I saw they remade Mulan.
The funniest thing is all their legacy. And I know, I think somebody already alluded to it earlier in this episode. All their legacy stuff, especially Mickey Mouse, it doesn't get much screen time anymore. They do they'll do some kind of like little show or something, or like a little short, or find some avenue to use the property in some, maybe like in a video game or something. But there's not going to ever be another Mickey Mouse movie. They're constantly in the prowl for trying to find what the next most relevant thing, and I think that's only been amplified even more so after the success of Frozen. But they don't even care about their own products. It's just there to as a merchandising thing.
Have you seen Frozen?
I have.
What is your take on Frozen?
it's very flash, and it's very much, there's a very insidious quality to it where the little girls that love that movie don't really understand what they're signing up for. It has that very sickly cloying, but you think it tastes really good when you drink it, kind of soda pop quality to it.
Isn't it like Sex in the City for kids or something?
Yes. Yes, I'd say exactly that. It's a horrible, horrible analogy, and therefore it is correct.
Yeah, there's definitely an undertone. I watched it recently for the first time. I can't remember why. I think I was like really hungover, and I was like trying. My buddy was over, and I was like, sometimes I do this. Like, it's like a game where it's like I'm waiting for someone to like, you know, fucking like throw something at the television or like physically turn it off, but then they don't. And so it keeps playing and we end up watching it. And I was a little bit curious because, you know, I see the shit everywhere and I didn't find it to be very insightful watching it. Like I can't say I really got why. I guess I kind of get why it appeals to little girls, but not really. I mean,
were you too hungover for the MKUltra to take effect? Is that right? Sat there and watched it.
Well, I think it's because he was too busy doing his own MK Ultra operation on his friends.
Right. Yeah. God, I remember when I have actually never like watched that whole movie, but I remember I was in college when that came out, and at my university, which shall remain nameless, there was like a flash mob thing to that Let It Go song, and there was well over 30. 19-year-olds who were singing one of the plazas to this just randomly one day, to getting openly emotional as they sang, like tears down their eyes. That was the moment when I decided to read Siege. But I mean, you know, I do want to say, like, it does speak to the fucking power of these films. I mean, I'm not kidding when this is like MK Ultra. It is interesting that their films do have the ability to resonate so much with people emotionally that it becomes to define their whole life, kind of what Borzoi was saying at the beginning. People in there are tens of millions of Americans right now who have own like products related to movies made ostensibly for children who are in their 30s. And this is like, there's like a whole sub industry around cultural procurement and refinement related to Disney content. It's shocking. Like it is absolutely shocking.
Well, think about this. I mean, it's one of the greatest tricks that the culture parasite has played, where and basically, mind fuck an entire generation to the point where they can get those people when they become adults and they become parents to do it to their own children.
Well, and it gets infused with modern politics, which is, I think, where it becomes dangerous. I have to say that I have seen quite a few suburban soccer moms recently rocking the Princess Leia, a female's place is in the resistance yard sign. It's become an aspect of political stance, the same way these goofballs have like Harry Potter quotes and all that sort of stuff. It's become an aspect of their entire life is referencing cheap pieces of fiction.
We have to hesitate about underestimating this stuff, because there is a lot of sophistication that goes into both this and into the cape shit. It's like on its face, there is an esoteric layer to it where, like, if you watch some of these, I remember the Shrek film, a long time ago. That was one that was very egregious in the sense that it had like these, it was like two films at once. It was actually kind of a obscene film, but a lot of the obscenity to it was something that only adults would really be able to get. I mean, I'm sure it sinks into the little brains too somehow, but they do that because like parents, like, I see this all the time, man. I see parents who like, they use this stuff as a way to babysit their children, and then they'll have it playing nonstop, and it's, something that they end up having to watch too. And this stuff that's geared to parents and to children at the same time, right?
I've been thinking about this, and I had a lot of interesting conversations that came out of watching that film, and we ended up trying to analyze this whole Disney film aspect. She likes a couple of movies, but she's never been involved in the whole Disney culture. But we both know women who are obsessed with Disney, and Disney is identity to them. So I started trying to puzzle out why this is. What is the power of these films? What is built into this? And it's like, I don't even think I'm scratching the surface on it, but you have this combination of this pseudo rite of passage that a lot of these movies give the viewer, especially from a young age, combined with this idealized form of your individuality, as well as these films are suffused with an obscenity, with a sexual imagery in this. There is a strong connection between pornography and Disney and a lot of the fucked up fetishes that come out of all that. They go, some of them have their beginnings in Disney films. You really trace the genealogy on some of that stuff. So it implants the stuff very deep into people's minds at an early age, and then it creates, I mean, that's not for nothing that Nick called this like trauma-based, not mind control. Disney films are inherently traumatic, and they do inflict traumatic mental wounds, especially in the film itself, onto young people.
I mean, think of, like, for example, the scene in The Lion King where the father dies. I mean, that is a severely traumatic scene. There's no going back. There's no magic wand that's waved. The father is dead. Are you at all familiar? Are any of you familiar with Henry Darger?
I know the name. Oh, that's the guy from Illinois who did all those weird, like, he had that whole thing with this whole magical story of all these drawings, drew like a lot of involved naked little girls, didn't it?
Yes, he was there's a film that was made about him, a documentary called Into the Realms of the Unreal, and it's been years since I've seen it, but I often think about him because in a certain sense I consider him as basically the the archetype, like a final product of this, of the Disney mindset that we're dealing with here. And what it is, I mean, he was mentally, you know, retarded in some way. I don't know exactly what his specific condition was, but he was working as a janitor throughout his entire life. That was the job he could do. And he kept to himself. But upon his apartment, these paintings, like a lot of these, and he had this book that was a mixture of paintings and sort of a children's book, and it was very long, and it has been published in some forms as kind of a curiosity. I mean, it would be impossible to edit it into something truly coherent and also to find a market for it. But he's been sort of this figure, because what happened was there were these cases of these missing girls, and a lot of them bore the likeness of girls that were in his artwork. And the fiction, the actual written word, contains some very dark stuff. And I think that this is a common theme that you see amongst child predators and other assorted damaged people, where, you know, obviously, like, the soccer mom is not on that level. But I think that there is... what Disney affords, what these kinds of things afford, is they create the entire illusion of your childhood. And so your childhood has nothing but these images and these, you know, forms that have been implanted in you. And the childhood is, you know, something always the people would like to go back to in some form or another, especially when, you know, life becomes troubled in one way or another. It's the time of innocence, or at least the time that you think was of innocence, because sometimes, you know, bad things happen, and then this is how you were treated into, or something like this. I think this is some of the psychology that's going on there. And it's not surprising that, you know, weirdos would be drawn to creating children's material, because I think it's very hard for adults. You know, you have to maybe be somebody like a Walt Disney, someone who really is just kind of a pure soul, who's, you know, kind of naive Midwesterner on a certain level. I don't know how naive he was by the end of his life, but it's very difficult for mature adults who have dealt with actual realities of life to put themselves in a headspace material that is, you know, truly innocent. In fact, it's very rare. I mean, look at some of the most famous children's fables, like the Brothers Grimm. I mean, these aren't, you know, we think of them as children's fables, but there's very little innocence involved.
Well, that was one of the theories why Disney was struggling in, like, the 70s, which was... relatively speaking, compared to other decades, maybe not modern.
It was a dark time.
But it was a rough time. And Disney was traditionally a much more optimistic, hopeful, some would say naive, storytelling company. And those stories were meeting up with things like Taxi Driver, where a guy is basically shaving his head and going on a murderous rampage against the town pimp. And it's just hard to put up, you know, Goofy and Mickey against that and expect to sell tickets. And I guess they were able to make the transition into the 90s, when maybe America somewhat... you know, resolved some of the crime issues. Crime did go down quite a bit. And so I don't know if that explains some of the resurgence of Disney. But I would also say America has gone online, not no pun intended, to really escape the ridiculousness of things that are going on. And I think actually today, people, despite having horrible environmental conditions, have retreated so far into their internet and computer and electronic and smartphone cocoons that they're actually less cynical in some ways, because they live in these echo chambers and curate their little walled gardens so much that if they ever happen to wander out the front door, they just stumble right back inside onto Disney Plus and just avoid the whole mess. So I'm trying to, like, explain how Disney has, until recently, perhaps with some of the acquisition overpaying and COVID stuff, they have seemingly done fairly well. I think their stock was performing quite well until about the last year. It's interesting. Well,
one of my favorite artists that really addresses these themes thoroughly throughout his career is Terry Gilliam. And I don't remember, Boyzoy, if I went on your program to discuss the film Brazil or not. I feel like,
yes,
I did.
Yes, you did.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite.
That was not one of your fever dreams, Nick, or one of your weird fantasies that you have. That one.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so that, I mean, that Brazil deals with that from the perspective of an adult who lives in a society that offers no hope and only slavery. And the way that he addresses, you know, the way he copes with it is by retreating into fantasy. But of all of Terry Gilliam's films, Brazil's my favorite, but he also did, by the way, a very, I think, underrated Brothers Grimm film. It got a lot of hate, but I actually think it was good. You know, come at me, bro. But the darkest of his films, which I put off watching until recently, easily the darkest, very difficult film to watch in a lot of ways, is the film Tideland. And I think Tideland sums up this with respect to children, because what the premise of Tideland is, basically a child is being subjected to basically the worst forms of abuse, abandonment, and horror that could possibly happen. I mean, her father ODs on heroin, and she's left to wander this countryside where there's, you know, other damaged people and, you know, nefarious actors. But the way that she copes with this, and much of the film's perspective, is told from her fantasies and her imagination. Because children, in certain sense, are resilient to a point, you know, because eventually they're going to have to come into the world. And if they've been able to, you know, shield themselves and cocoon themselves in some kind of fantasy, they may not be able to transition correctly into reality when the time comes. But that, if you have the stomach for it, that movie is very good, but it is extremely dark.
So I wanted to say, it's interesting Adam brought up Taxi Driver, and you know, how do you...
Oh, was that what he was talking about? I thought he was talking about Nick for when he was describing that.
It was... Wait, what?
Never mind, it was a joke. No. When he was talking about shaving your head, Adam, and going after your local pimp.
Yeah, so Adam brought up Taxi Driver earlier, and you said it, he made a good point, that it's hard to throw Goofy against you know, that kind of film, especially in an era as terrible as the 1970s. And you know, Disney did get into that game, though. Disney purchased Miramax in the 90s and worked with Harvey Weinstein and basically produced for over a decade a litany of sexually pervasive and violent and kind of transgressive films of all shapes and sizes. So Disney was not above, as a company, was not above getting into that racket when they realized that it, you know, basically that point, you know, America is becoming a more cynical country. We have a declining populace. People are less and less interested in optimism. Even in the 90s, people were less interested in optimism. And so we might as well create content, not for the family, but for different groups of people at any given time. We'll have the general action adventure stuff occasionally, maybe for the family. And that kind of became Pixar for some time. And you know, certain franchises. But they had Miramax strictly as a way of generating revenue from a market that was feeding off of and feeding into, I think, the growing cynicism and alienation a lot of Americans are feeling. And the entire notion of the art house, you know, film connoisseur and the Harvey Weinstein film award racketeering operation and all that sort of stuff, Disney was in on that. Mostly, I think, because they saw it as a great way to make money, but also partially because it granted them that kind of maybe seal of approval from the film critic community that they too were capable of entering into this sort of morass of hopelessness and of what was perceived as being adult-worthy entertainment. I think that's what the Miramax acquisition and their collaboration with Weinstein was really about at its core. And you know, Disney has faced actually increased scrutiny over Weinstein. There's been multiple allegations that Disney executives took the time to protect Weinstein. There's at least one person who's filed a, I think, $60 million lawsuit against Disney over the Weinstein fiasco. And so this is, again, a company that's descended very rapidly into like the scum of Hollywood in the passing of the original Disney family. And
has now ingratiated itself in a community that is increasingly like obsessed with trying to be transgressive, trying to be violent, trying to be sexually forward thinking, I guess. And it doesn't show any signs of stopping. You know, that Disney, I don't think, has a real relationship with Miramax anymore. It doesn't have a relationship with Harvey Weinstein anymore. But it doesn't preclude Disney from getting into that game again. And I think increasingly, they've been able to fulfill the transgressiveness and the violence and sort of the insanity of Miramax films with their sports acquisitions. You know, Disney is basically overseeing all of these indignant freaks, kneeling for the national anthem at a football game. Disney owns ESPN. They own all the anchors who applaud and cheer this on. They pay their bills. So Disney, you know, is ultimately overseeing, I think, their version of adult entertainment, which is sports, and trying to do exactly what they've been doing to their other kinds of multimedia products, which is corrupt them and merchandise them and wrap it in a nice little package and engage at the same time in sort of social crusading. It's a very, very powerful, multi-pronged approach to cultural domination. And I think Hank has said this before, and I think he would say it if he were here tonight. Disney, you know, the Walt Disney Corporation is one of the primary obstacles to any real formation of a genuine American culture.
Yes. And so if I could tie in what you're saying here, Hans, with the points I was trying to make, if I had to sum up what we're dealing with here as simply as I could, I'd say that it is a form of arrested development. And when you talk to tie together, you know, sports ball with childhood trauma, child abuse, you know, sex slavery, et cetera. It is, I mean, because the worst, the archetype, and the reason I brought up a deranged man like Henry Darger is because he really represents that, where it's somebody who has never, for whatever reasons, whatever happened, never really to grow and mature as an adult emotionally and spiritually. And like Disney is, that's what is being deployed against America. American culture as a whole has been in arrested development since the European war. And it has not grown and it has only stagnated. And then this has happened on the individual level as well. But this is happening, you know, to families and to people who are still caught up in this. They haven't been able to address what's happening in the world around them as mature. And I do think that Disney bears largely the blame for this. And I mean, it's just one tentacle of Hollywood at this point, but it's the one that's pointed at the children.
One of the most telling things as well about Disney, the Disney company, isn't what they promote, it's what they don't promote anymore. And Nick has said this twice now in the episode, but it's completely on point that they would not be able to create what Walt Disney created. Only Walt Disney could have created Tomorrowland, and there's never going to be another Tomorrowland. There never will be. This is a part. This was his vision of the future. Walt Disney had a very forward. For all that he's talked about as like this old conservative heartland fogey, there's been no other American in the 20th century that had quite the forward-looking vision of science and exploration that he had, at least with the platform that he did. His park, Tomorrowland.
It was almost archaeo-futuristic. Yeah. I mean, in the sense that it was backwards-looking into the European roots of American culture and forward-looking to.
I mean, his producer for the park, Ward Kimball, they had Wernher von Braun come and do technical consultation for the park. He, for his inauguration on it, he said, "Tomorrow can be a wonderful age. Our scientists today are opening the doors of the space age to achievements that will benefit our children and generations to come. The Tomorrowland attractions have been designed to give you an opportunity to participate in adventures that are a living blueprint of our future." I can't even imagine anybody saying something like that today, even if they meant what they were saying.
Well, when you look at Tomorrowland, I wanted to bring this up earlier. Tomorrowland was like a big exposition park almost. It was like there were corporate partnerships for a while. And this was in the golden age of American industry. And so you would have DuPont and General Motors and GE and, you know, Alcoa and you know, the, like the titans of American industry, like real industry. And obviously people like Von Braun, and you would have, you know, people who were more into aeronautics, people who were to all realms of chemistry would come to the park. They'd have exhibits. They would show off corporate R&D for free to those who had paid the price of admission. They would walk people through what they're working on. They would have scientists and employees and technicians come to show things off. They would try and create this newfangled, but very kind of earnest, futuristic aesthetic with everything, right? They wanted to imagine the future right in front of you. And they wanted to show you a picture of what the future might look like. And that's all gone now because American industry is gone. You know, American ingenuity and the innovative spirit, what did we call it on the episode for Hoover, the Promethean spirit of that era.
Well, he actually talked about the rugged individual. I don't know if he coined that, but that was one of the earlier usages of that term, if I'm not mistaken.
The rugged individual, but also the Promethean spirit of American industry and science, you know, and bringing the light to the masses. And that sort of message was part of Tomorrowland. And I think that, you know, if you try to do that today, people would say that's antiquated, that's hokey. You know, that's like from the 50s, he would accuse you of being anachronistic. You know, people now
they do, but there's the exception of Elon Musk. And for whatever reason, the stars have aligned, again, no pun intended, or the CIA has aligned behind him. But the media seems to consider him untouchable. And his wonky ideas about going to Mars, which I think is basically a waste of time considering that half of our major cities are on fire, seems to distract the population, which is
part of what the point is. It's not a waste of time. We got to get the hell off this planet.
I mean, it's almost like the moon stuff was like during the same racial unrest during the 60s as a distraction. I mean,
yeah.
Again, this is one of my suspicions behind this guy. It's like, what is, and he goes on Rogan, and Rogan's moving to Austin next to Alex Jones. I mean, it just screams of spookery to me. But you know,
what does Hank call him? He calls him the Reddit Whisperer.
Yeah, and Twitter.
He is. But you know, I want to say too. I think Borzoi, were you saying there's like no one really like Walt, who's kind of imbibed that American spirit? The only other man I can, that forward-thinking optimism. The only other man I can think of who did, on other than Von Braun had come to mind, would be Henry Ford. Henry Ford, for sure, I think, really believed in the optimism of America, really believed in the kind of the old ways and the yeoman American man and trying to bring happiness and bring a slice of a better life to everyone, you know, for a low cost. You know, that
the attitude was that technology would serve, these new technologies would come to serve and improve the lives of the people, as opposed to be tools to dominate them and enslave them.
And even to his
spirit under Aryan futurism is what it was.
And
yes.
To Ford's additional credit, I would argue, he came to realize and even though it was his own concept, he came to realize that it may have been misguided, because he started to see the effects of industrialization and urbanization on the working class, and how they were basically being stripped away from their own land, and they had to work in these giant factories. And
he River Rouge, right, that he grew to hate, because it was this massive factory that kind of went on forever. And
he lived out his days living in sort of a pastoral existence at in his twilight
he did.
Years.
He took up camping.
To get on my box for a minute, I have been posting on the Twitter a lot lately about the joys of car ownership and the automobile. And this comes to a point I want to make about the conservative or reactionary take on something like Disney. I disagree. My attitude towards all this stuff, you know, I'm not in favor of some kind of cybernetic future per se, but the way I look at this is this technology exists. It existed, you know, throughout the 20th century, and the problem was not the tool itself, but the user of the tool. We have to control these things.
Sure.
If we don't, our enemies will.
That's right. Yeah. You can't become Amish and defeat an enemy who uses the latest and greatest information, industrial, chemical, scientific advantages that are known to man. They'll destroy you, unfortunately.
If we aren't teaching the children the correct myths, then our enemies will. They'll teach them the wrong ones. They'll
That's
teach
also
them the
true.
Ones that will turn them into perverts. You know,
yeah, the war for the traitors. Mind and the hearts are yeah. arguably the biggest battle.
It's not people are to be negative, gonna, you have to be positive.
People are probably going to cancel.
What's that, Borzai?
Well, people are probably going to cancel Disney after it's disclosed that Wernher von Braun gave a speech there.
Well, like, you know, let's get that trending then. But what I yeah. was what I was saying, Nick, I know this is something that's near and dear to your heart, is that it's not enough to be against something. It's not enough to be negative. We have to be positive. We have to be affirmative in what we are and what we are teaching and what we believe. It's not enough to be against it. We have to be for something. We have to teach our kids to be for something.
And it's not just our particular orientation, you know, I mean, in our personal lives and what we put out there. The reality is, like, we must control these actual institutions or, you know, or burn them to the ground. They cannot be allowed to exist in enemy hands.
I do want to say, what do you guys think the future of Disney is? Assuming that COVID kind of whittles itself down and becomes more of a non-factor and the film production resumes and the Cape Ship production resumes and the Star Wars production resumes and the entertainment facilities and theme parks resume, you know, do you think that people will immediately fall back into that psychological trap? Or do you think that having a break from it effectively might have actually done some good and allowed people to try and slowly wean themselves off of the content addiction cycle that Disney has sort of perfected?
There may not be a content generation pipeline at the moment because of social distancing requests / requirements in California, but the fact is, I think people are probably consuming more of this content on their screens during a time like this, and I don't think this has had any positive effect in weaning them off of it. It's possible it has, but my intuition would say it hasn't. And I would also say going forward that these companies, Disney is just among many in Hollywood and perhaps other places, but mainly Hollywood, I would argue, they're very good at what they do. And so we can't underestimate them. And I think the only real opportunity here is to recognize that they are sort of putting their platform into an ideological space that has a lack of appeal to people like us. And I would only hope to encourage people to realize that that is an opening in the marketplace to create better content. Frankly, content like Disney used to create. And I think if somebody could do that, I think there would be demand for it.
I'm hoping we're starting to see the stirrings of more, and this is all concurrent with what's been going on in the political environment of more and more people plugging out, more and more people moving away from it. I don't know how much of that is enough to make waves when on the ideological level, but I'm seeing, at least anecdotally, more and more disgust and realization of it. It's, you know, like the whole Epcot experience of how it's reduced culture to cheapened and overpriced experiences. But what I think Disney's going to do in response to that is they're going to try to adapt to these changes in people's habits, and they may trial run different ways of how they can fast deliver content and get screens in front of people's faces any way possible. Even if they have to go towards a more diminished model, that perhaps there is going to be this pause in the whole everybody goes to the theater and watches this on the big screen experience. Even if they have to put a pause on that, they're going to figure out, try to look for a way to get people's faces in front of screens again, at least more than the dip that they're experiencing right now.
Is there a future for the Star Wars franchise that they've torpedoed? Is there a future for Marvel? I on some level, I do wonder when this stuff wears itself out. People talk about in the 60s, there was the Western bubble, right? Hollywood was making a ton of Western and period pieces, and it all kind of collapsed. Is there a bad Disney franchise bubble that eventually is going to implode, or are people just so addicted to this now as a form of pseudo culture that it'll never go away?
That's a great question. It's hard to say because the culture has been shattered so much that even if people kind of drift away from Disney's, what are they drifting towards?
Well, yeah.
Well, the war is for the children, though, man. I mean, like, the Reddit demographic of grown men who are excited about Cape shit. These people don't matter. They're already dead. So, you know, we got to look to the thing that really does freak me out, man, is like, you know, good people, like people who, you know, they're not garbage people, but they're working people. You know, I see this a lot. You know, they put like a tablet in front of their kids or whatever because, you know, they've worked all day. They can't. They're going to be showing them content or something, you know, and it's just they're not engaged quite enough to know what what I do. And to friends of mine who are in the situation, her parents, I will loan them, as I have a good collection of them, I will loan them Miyazaki films. And I get it. You can only watch so many. There's only so many Miyazaki films, but, you know, there needs to, rather than trying to get people to like totally change how they live their lives. I mean, it is what it is. There needs to be alternatives or at least some way to, you know, have approved content, you know, socially responsible and moral content be approved and be allowed to, so that parents can have it easy and know what they can show to their kids.
Yeah. I'm just hoping that we see a return to families filling their home full of beautiful things and good culture and just anything, and just things are just objectively beautiful. I know we are planning on doing that. I know it's going to be probably a while before I see this in every home I walk into, but I'm hoping for that day where we have something that we can be proud of and that we know is healthy for us and our kids.
Well, you know, I think on the Star Wars front, this is something that I haven't really been able to talk to many people about this. And I refuse to like watch these Star Wars movies. I only know anything about them just by watching the RLM reviews of these films.
Everything you need to know, basically.
That's all you need to know.
Same.
And basically what it feels like to me is that ironically, this is the closest thing to optimistic and semi-lighthearted science fantasy or science fiction in like the entire American cultural sphere. Most of American science fantasy or science fiction is absolutely dismal now. Probably the best science fiction film in several years was Blade Runner 2049, which is horribly depressing and existentially...
Did not like that movie.
Existentially freakish. So it is ironic that Disney is actually still trying to be, in a way, optimistic and lighthearted, maybe. But it's for all the wrong reasons. And it's to sell all of these kinds of messages. And you kind of get the sense that really what Disney is attempting to do is create a lighthearted pseudo culture as a kind of control method for the increasingly unwinding America, right? Like, you know, the modern, diverse, progressive take on Star Wars is the closest thing to like a national unification culture that we have, that, you know, a people from a wide spectrum can go watch, right? And so Disney is sort of trying to fulfill this role, I think, as a national unification that is not explicitly political, right? But it is sort of implicitly political. And so that is kind of odd in that they are still attempting to be lighthearted, optimistic, forward-thinking. But it's really an attempt to, I think, make people sort of less concerned with the widening social collapse that's going on.
I will give a shout out based on what you're saying, Hans. I'm not going to say I fully endorse the movie, but I thought it was a very interesting film because in a certain sense, I took it as almost like the last American science fiction film. It's a movie called Ad Astra, you know, To the Stars.
Yeah. Good movie.
It is an interesting movie, but the whole premise of the film is that Brad Pitt's father, played by Tommy Lee Jones, he's out in this, you know, out in the deep vastness of the void, and he's, you know, lost contact and doesn't, you know, maybe has gone crazy or something, and Brad Pitt is sent to find him. And spoilers, he does find him, and the reason that he's out there is because he still believes that there's something out there, you know, in the void, that there's something to find, some intelligence, that the frontier is not just an endless vast nothingness. And the point of the movie is that, like, there isn't anything out there, and Brad Pitt tries to get him to come back, and he refuses and chooses death instead. And that's you know, it is like sort of the final note to science fiction in a certain sense. I mean, it's like there's nothing more to see here, folks. There's nothing more to dream about or, you know, speculate about.
Well, yeah, I think that again, you increasingly get this sense that because American culture is just on the decline, right? I think that there's this
it's a film of the decline, no doubt.
Yeah, I think there's this implicit queasiness that people feel, whether or not they want to admit it, they feel it in their chest, of anxiety over what is now apparent as a lost future, right? The future represented in Blade Runner or Ad Astra or even Moon or any of these like more recent but somewhat depressing and melancholic science fiction films, even that's sort of out of the window, I think, of opportunity for people. And they realize it now. And so, Disney is like this last attempt at being lighthearted and fruitful and entertaining. And as a way of like as a backdrop against not just cynicism of like the 1970s, but I think a deep existential realization that the jig is up, like the civilization is just in complete decline. And we are imagining a future that we wanted to have. But even in the imagination, it's depressing. We can't imagine anything beyond a depressing failure in a scientific future. Even like you look at something like the original Star Trek series, that sort of optimism of the 1960s is just completely eroded. No one thinks anymore that the future is going to be, you know, gentlemen negotiating and being somewhat peaceful and rationalistic and using military power very prudently and focusing on exploration and discovery. You know, that's all out of the window. Now, you know, the central drama of science fiction is fathers who hate their sons and vice versa, and people who question whether or not they're actually a person. And, you know, it's like the entire thing is existential dread. And Disney is the only company that is so far not indulged that kind of dread. It would be interesting to see if they, in a perverse turn, eventually try and inflict that on families and kids, you know, a sense of dread and sort of unbecoming.
Yeah, the real future is going to look more like, or at least the real optimistic future, is going to be stacking Mickey Mouse bodies in Disneyland and seeing what's under those fucking tunnels.
Someday I'll take you to Disneyland. Someday, I'll take you to Disneyland. We'll go on Mr. Toad's wild ride and follow him straight to hell. But that's not necessary just now. For now, hell's all around us. No rubber devils. No smell of sulfur. But hell nonetheless. Hell more grotesque than any medieval woodcut. Instead of dramatic demons, a lifeless shuffling horde without souls, without imagination, without worth, and beyond redemption. Someday I'll take you to Disneyland. I'll buy you a pair of mouse ears, tons of cotton candy, and a big helium balloon with Mickey inside. But all that can wait. Today I'll buy you a .357 Magnum and lots of bullets. I'll buy you a stack of AK-47s and a warehouse filled with banana clips, all loaded and ready to go. I'll buy you a B-52 loaded with neutron bombs and lots of soldiers to do whatever's necessary. Disneyland can wait. We have time. Someday there'll be more of us. Maybe then the world can be Disneyland. And visiting hell will be novel again.